damning indictments bring you
Phoenix City.
Welcome to Phoenix City. As you can tell, I'm not Patrick. I'm Frosty. I'm joined here by Cam.
Good evening.
And Dave. How are we, lads?
Hello.
I'm okay.
Yeah, finish your mouthful first.
Got a mouthful of food, yeah, but we started a little bit quicker than I was anticipating.
Yeah, we've got to get into it. We're pissing around. We're not Patrick here, so into it. So there's been quite a bit, I think, despite the fact that there's not been much to talk about in Nickstown, there's been the odd little thing, and it's more the absence of things.
Yeah, it's been a funny old week, and in many ways, it was only 2 days ago we were talking about
not
having enough to talk about, and all of a sudden we have everything to talk about.
Yeah,
everything is quite the word. Not much from the Knicks, but probably the lack of much from the Knicks is more of the issue, isn't it?
I think that's what's driving the apathy. I'm usually this time of year, and actually Patrick made a good point to me today, it would be this weekend that would be kicking off. Usually this is the weekend that the season would kick off.
Interesting.
And because we're 3 weeks later now because of the international breaks are being observed, so kicking off 3 weeks later than we usually would. There hasn't been a game in Wellington since the Capity game. There's been no signings. We don't have a full squad. And we're only 3 weeks out from the season. No,
not even a full squad. We don't even have a minimum squad yet.
Yeah, don't have a minimum at all. And there's a lot of... I know, apathy, and I guess that's the best way to describe how I'm feeling towards the season at the moment. Usually by now,
you're annoying.
Yeah, I'm annoyingly excited, and that's you know, I am the positive one in the pod, obviously. So
it's a funny one because I, in many ways, I feel quite positive, but also, as you say, there's not, I don't know that I go so far as to say I feel apathetic about things, but I definitely am not as excited as I normally would be about some things, but in other things I am. Like, I look at the players we do have and I actually go, that's really good. There's a couple of gaps there that I'd like to see filled for sure. But what we have does excite me. You know, Taylor's a great signing. That's fantastic.
He's brilliant.
You know, Mitch Nichols as well. I mean, there's a lot to dislike about him, but I also think he's a great player and he scores goals in the A-League. We've seen it time and time again. I'm excited about that. But at the same time, we need four more players in the next couple of weeks.
And it two of them need to be
like
starters.
The season's 2 weeks away, you know? It feels like we're in the middle of the off season, and I'm kind of at that level of excitement rather than we're only a couple of weeks from go time.
And you know what? Previous seasons to this, there's always been that game the week before the season kicks off, which has been at the stadium. It's been against Team Wellington or Auckland City, or it's been the Knicks versus Knicks intra-squad game or something along those lines. I think they played Canterbury there as well previously. And that comes a week or two before the season. And that's what I think I'm missing, because then we get back to the stadium. You're getting, even if it's just a smidgen of the atmosphere, you're in your, you know, in your home ground, and it kind of starts to build the excitement again. Yep. I kind of need one of those just to drive home the fact that it's almost season kickoff, or some, and I know obviously they're trying, but some name to pin a hat on for a signing or something along those lines. I don't know. I want to be really, really excited, and I just can't drag myself there at the moment.
Well, and somehow we're not. I mean, we're going to talk about it properly later, but the FFA stuff means essentially today or yesterday, whenever you want to kind of decide it as, the license thing is no longer a problem. That is a huge weight off as a Phoenix fan, and yet I somehow still don't feel a level of excitement that I would have thought I would feel about that. You know, I am excited. I'm like, shit, that's great. We've been wanting that for years now, and it's happened. And it just, like, even that isn't pushing me to some kind of new level of excitement.
But it should be party town right now. I mean, obviously there's other steps they need to go through to confirm it, but this is the first massive step in a process.
This is huge.
It's the best possible outcome. We've started down that path, basically. You know, we're not there yet, but it's of the possible ways this could have gone, we've ended up in the one that is by far the best for the Phoenix. And it seems pretty clear cut it's going to continue along that trajectory. You know, it doesn't seem like there's going to be any roadblocks to this.
So do we think the apathy, the malaise we're feeling at the moment is just because of the squad, you know, the players that we don't have, that we have possibly two starters that we're probably missing, and we definitely need four players just to hit minimums?
Yep. I think that's definitely a factor. And I think, as you've said, we had some games in Wellington, but I think for whatever reason the last few weeks we kind of haven't had that, and that's felt like a bit of a gap. You know, we've normally had a bit of a roll through, and I think on a personal level, like I didn't make it to the club members' day, or what do we even call that, open day,
community day.
That day I didn't make it along because I was busy with some other commitments, so I've missed that as well. But it feels like a long time since I've seen the Phoenix in Wellington or had anything Phoenix related. So I think that's a factor. But at the same time, the other part of me thinks it's great that we're over in Australia having a bit of a tour there, because that's actually better preparation than being here.
Can't argue with that prep at all.
I haven't been able to watch any of it. You know, it hasn't been televised. I haven't had streams to watch. You know, it's hard to get excited about the football coming soon when I'm not seeing any football. But at the same time, I totally understand why they're over in Australia doing that instead. It just feels the timing is somehow different to what we've had previous years. And at the same time, we've had podcast appearances with the guys going on the Fox one they were on. Rudan's been saying a lot of the right things in the media, and all that stuff is all really positive. And yet just not seeing football in front of my eyes is making it hard to get on board with that.
Yeah.
So coming back to the definite things that we can say
yep.
there are issues with. What's the timing, remind me again, of when we have to have our players signed by?
I actually don't know, but
I don't know either.
There must be a day before the match day where we have to submit and register a squad.
I've got to be thinking it's at least a week before.
Wouldn't
it be when our transfer window closes?
The Australian window.
So possibly for signing new players, but to submit at least the minimum squad requirement, because we could still sign some players after that. But I would agree. I would think it's a week out. Maybe it's the Monday of the first round.
Yeah. And that's not that far away. No, our first game's the 21st.
We're 18 days away from
18 days, yeah.
First game. So let's say we've got less than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I think the reality is Domi was on, I'm going to say, Radio Sport today.
Yeah, he was.
And he was talking about how they've got some stuff in the works on that. You know, they're feeling comfortable with where they're at.
Did you believe him?
I think it's true that we've got some stuff in the works.
I think we probably have
four players we're going to sign there. I don't think they're necessarily the two starters you want. I don't think we have starting quality right back, starting quality number nine in those negotiations now. I think we probably have four names that can get us to the 20 we need and be serviceable. And I don't think there'll be signings we'll be upset with, but they'll be squad players. They'll be depth rather than starters. So, and maybe let's say be generous and assume one of them is a starter. I don't think we've got two starters just floating around.
No,
we just haven't put
into paper. Not to this timing. You wouldn't be able to squeeze two. I can't see how. But the name that seems to kind of pop up is Callan Elliott.
Yep.
So it sounds like he'll be signed.
Yep, I would assume he's one of our four.
But I was under the impression he was a young fella, so wouldn't be getting a senior contract. He'd be getting one of the. But you need.
I think he's old enough that he can be on a senior contract.
Right. Okay.
That
it's a question of whether he's kind of deserving of a senior contract for mine. I mean, I think he's a really good player, but you know, he's certainly unproven at this level, and we've seen players of his ilk kind of get the junior contracts. Heard that Andre De Jong probably won't get signed.
Yep. My understanding is he's back at Eastern Suburbs.
Yep. Which is interesting. I've heard nothing about Jacob Tratt one way or the other. I've heard both rumors in both directions. So who the hell knows?
I mean, I think with him, it just remains whether or not they can get that balance right with the personal issues that meant he left in the first place. I think they're giving him the best possible chance to stay here and try and, you know, make that work. And the club are trying to figure out ways they can, you know, work around that as well. But I would say they're both sides probably aren't confident they've solved it yet. So give it as much time as they can, I guess.
His on-field performance in the preseason games would indicate his ability is not diminished.
Yeah.
So there's got to be something else around there.
Any question at all about whether or not they would sign him on football ability alone. I think it's the other stuff around that. That's the thing. So who knows how that'll go.
I hope it all gets sorted. I hope he stays. I really like the kid. And I like the way he plays football.
Absolutely. Yeah,
for sure. It has been brought up that maybe 5-3-2 does not suit his style. Yep. He is more of a robust, wide defender.
To be fair, when he played for us the season he did play for us, he was up and down that line all day.
Yeah, but it wasn't a natural thing for him. He's not an out-and-out fullback.
I disagree. I think he did enough to show that he could do up and down that line as necessary and provide that defensive stability, everything there that we require.
in part of a four, I would probably agree with you.
But with a five,
you have to be overlapping, and I see him as an overlapper.
No, see, I can see him overlap. I think the key qualifier I'd put on this is I think he can do it to an A-League quality. I don't think he's, you know, a world-beating fullback.
Yeah, it's fair. That's a fair point.
But I think an A-League quality fullback, he absolutely can be.
Fair enough. Yeah. I certainly would be signing him, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He's a top-notch defender.
It still leaves a question on who the two other names are if we're just trying to reach four.
Yeah, exactly.
I trust Domi that he's got this.
Oh, you see, for me, listening to him, you know, I trust that Domi's got four names that he can pull out, but I think it's going to be those two, hopefully, and I suspect it'll basically be two academy-level players that are
I think it's more likely junior. To be two NPL-level players that – probably from Sydney that Mark Rudan knows.
Yeah. I would say that's the thing. I trust Rudan to get this sorted. I think we're cutting it a bit fine, and I suspect Domi will be trusting Mark that he has these names that he wants, and that they'll pull it together.
I guess with the FFA Cup just kind of winding up for a lot of those teams, maybe there's a couple of names he wanted to let get through their, you know, get through their tournament and actually kind of hit them up.
Well, and not to call them fullback options, but I think getting the squad right this year is very important. And I think not rushing into some of those names that they, I guess, know they don't have to rush with might not be the most silly thing. I mean, we're talking about four players, but really there's seven spots up for grabs still.
Yep.
Four's the immediate thing. But I think there might be a couple of players Rudan's had chats with and said, hey, you're well on my radar.
Just keep playing.
Keep your eyes open. Keep your eye on playing some football. I'll be talking to you soon.
He genuinely, as you point out, he may have just been waiting for those NPL seasons to finish. Yep. Those guys might already know that he wants them to come over. Just finish what you're doing now, and we'll talk at the end of the season.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm certainly hoping. One thing with Mark Rudan is you say he's been talking a good game.
Yep, absolutely.
One of the things I've really liked about the way he's talking appeals to my defender's nature is – he keeps bringing up turning West back into a fortress, you know, becoming that, setting up that siege mentality. And it's something that Ricky had done quite successfully, albeit a very limited approach. And I wonder if maybe there's, you know, that the Mark Rudan's natural approach is very similar to that. Maybe they'll tie together well. Maybe that ties into, you know, being Kiwis in a outside competition. I can hope. I mean, do you guys sense any of that at all? Or?
I mean, I like the way he's talking, and I think if he can execute on it, it's going to be really good. So the idea of turning Wellington and Westpac in particular back into the fortress that it had been, I think appeals to a lot of people. I mean, during the days where that was true and we were, you know, undefeated at home for long periods of time, the crowds looked good, because I think particularly being a rugby nation, we kind of don't actually watch a lot of pretty football. What we like seeing is winning football, regardless of how it happens. I mean, we scored some ugly, ugly goals during that period.
We did.
But a rugby crowd who you kind of need to be drawing in a little don't care about that. These don't need to be pretty goals. And so I think it just
needs to be plenty of them, that's all.
And not even necessarily that. A good 1-0 win still drew in crowds.
Ugly 1-0 win with drawn crowds.
And so, you know, we don't need to be absolutely pasting teams and scoring, you know, absolute screamers that, you know, make the highlights reel every week. I think setting up that fortress again will be fantastic. I think my concern is it's a nice idea. I don't know that the preseason results show we're going to do it. I certainly hope we will, but we do seem to be, you know, leaking a few goals here and there, and it's not, you know, a shut up shop us, you know, nicking one at the other end. That's not what we've seen.
So I think we haven't really leaked that many goals. For example, the preseason results that we've just seen was a 1-0 loss to Western Sydney and a 2-1 loss to Sydney FC, sandwiching a 3-0 win, I think, against one of the NPL sides, Sydney Olympic. I looking at where we were against Sydney and Western Sydney last season before, that result, even in preseason, is actually not that bad.
The thing that worries me is the West Sydney one in particular sounds like it was a very B squad they put out. It was their kids.
I recognised maybe two or three of the names.
It's hard to say, having not been able to watch the game. But
and you also know, if what he was trying to achieve.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, if we're talking about setting up a defensive fortress and they're playing a youth squad and we still leak one, you know, that's not super reassuring. It's not necessarily doom and gloom either, but if we were keeping a lot of clean sheets here and talking about setting up that fortress, it would be a lot easier to believe. Whereas at the moment, I go on hope alone, and you know, I have a lot of hope. Every season, I have a lot of hope, but many times that spirit has been crushed.
For me, it's as much as we talk about that defensive thing, we've got to also remember how long ago it was and how much the league has progressed.
Yep.
It's no longer a league where strikers and attackers are borderline incompetent. It's now, you know, where you had Berisha and basically no one, as far as competitive in that kind of golden boot race. Whereas now you kind of look around and Sydney's got four guys of that ilk just in their squad at the moment.
Yeah.
Victory's probably got a similar number. Perth's basically signed everybody else. And you've got a good five or six teams that could really cut you apart if you're not really solid at the back. And that's my only concern but, you know, this is still the A-League. They're down here for a reason.
Yep.
You know, if they were finishing off one in every two chances, they'd be playing Bundesliga or, you know, Eredivisie. So anyway.
And just on that, just before we move on, one final point. I think the other concern is if we are going to, you know, against some of those quality strikers you're talking about there, because I agree, the quality of the strike forces across the league is so much better. Ours really isn't. If we do leak one, you know, jammy goal and, you know, we're suddenly finding ourselves 1-0 down, there's really only Krishna in many ways, it feels like, to drag us back into the game by the scruff of the neck. You know, we don't have a lot of passionate, competent strikers ourselves. So I think we've seen previously what happens to him when the pressure's on him. It really gets to him. When it's going well, that's great. Pressure's good. But he's very much a confidence striker. Mm. And if he's not banging them in, he's gonna get into that spiral again potentially. You've got a few guys around him to hopefully drag him back. You know, Mitch Nichols and Williams add a bit to that. But at that end of the field worries me as well. If we do, you know, concede a jammy goal, I just, you know, I'm happy with a 3-2 win as much as a 1-0 win, but I don't see us scoring three with what we've got at the moment. You know?
Yeah, I struggle to see us scoring two because you kind of go, okay, maybe Singh gets you six goals a season. But that's out of 27 games, and then it's kind of like, well, who's getting the rest of them?
Roy only got four last year.
Yeah.
You know, therein lies our issue.
Roy can be good for
season.
25. Yeah. You know, he can have that sort of season, but
he needs
he
really to
needs
be.
To, he needs to have that
say
season.
To him, you've got to go out there and have a 25 goal season.
Yeah.
Puts a hell of a lot of pressure on the guy, and that pressure is not how he thrives.
Yeah.
He thrives when there's no pressure, and he can just go out there and play his game, and it happens.
I'd rather take 10 from him and 10 from Burns, and you know that we've probably done pretty well.
Yeah. But I can't see that happening either. I can't see Burns getting double figures particularly.
The ability is there. There's no question the ability is there. I think it all comes down to confidence. And if he gets that confidence, he'll be fine. So basically get a couple in the first four or five games and I think he could be okay.
One thing the Knicks have done quite well, and that is their e-ticket. So I don't know about... I assume you got one, Dave.
I heard
you mentioning it.
It's good. I mean, it's a thing I gripe about every year. Many times I'm having to have quite tough discussions with the club around how much of a shambles the tickets have been at the start of the season. And I mean, it's in many ways how I initially got involved in the FIFA was writing an open letter slagging them off about it. But this season they seem to have got ahead of the game in a really smart way that it's so blindingly obvious to do this. I don't know why none of us have thought of it before, but it's fantastic that they have. And it's just kind of out there. They haven't been going, oh, we're going to do this. It just all of a sudden was in your inbox. And so they've given you literally an e-copy of your season pass. So it's the same barcode that'll be on your season ticket, and you have it already. So there's no need, if your mail gets lost or any of that kind of stuff, the delays that have happened in the past, to go and have to request paper tickets through calling the phone or, you know, any of that stuff.
For them to have to use a Sharpie to mark out some of the games on the back.
And so for now we have, like right now, I have a season ticket. If my real one arrives in time, which it sounds like it should, great. But if it doesn't, if there's any sort of mess up in the process, we're covered. And so I think there'll be some people listening to this who've made orders who still haven't got them. My understanding from reading a few forum posts and stuff today is that they're still doing some batch processing. So it looks like batch one has been processed and they have tickets. So depending on when you ordered, if you ordered the day the memberships are announced and you still haven't got your e-ticket, that might be worthy of concern. But if you waited a few weeks, yours is probably in batch two, or, you know, who knows how many batches they're gonna do. But I think...
Or if you haven't ordered it yet.
Correct.
Patrick. Patrick. Order your season ticket.
if I can be the voice of doom, don't throw away your paper ticket even if your pass arrives, just because those barcode readers aren't particularly great and they have been known. my season pass from last year still never worked. I literally just have to wave the guy and say, yeah, it's me again.
That's so funny.
Yeah, just grain of salt, but it is a good idea.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. So hopefully it pays off. And, you know, the reality is it sounds like they're ahead of the game. I mean, 3 weeks out from the first game, we're actually seeing something around membership packages. That's pretty good. Often we're down into the last week before season passes are arriving. So
speaking of good things for the Knicks, basically, for those that haven't been aware, there's been big rumblings over in Australia to do with the FFA. Now, about 3 years ago, FIFA decided that the FFA Congress wasn't representative enough of their members and made, shall we say, polite suggestions that they should reform. The FFA gave them the big, yeah, sure, what was translated in Australian to whatever. And then kind of left it, and FIFA came along last year and basically said, yeah, I was actually serious about that. And a congressional review working group was formed to suggest changes, and they came along and made, I think, about 8 suggestions, give or take. And the FFA basically said, bollocks to plan A. No, thanks. And so there was a lot of political machinations in between times, but especially in the last, say, 6 months, where the FFA, led by Stephen Lowy and David Gallop, have really tried to get a crowbar in there to stop this review process from happening. On the other side of the fence, there's been the A-League clubs represented by their – they have their own union. And so they've been pushing for – basically this review to happen, primarily because as part of that review, A-League would become an independent organisation and tournament, not administered by FIFA, not financially run and beholden to the FFA. So this all came to a head when there was an extraordinary general meeting called, and despite all the lobbying, the vote to basically approved these review changes was approved 8-2. If it had been one vote the other direction, yep, it would have failed. So that was the initial vote, and then the vote as to that was basically for FFA reform, and then to there was a second vote to, what was the wording, basically enact all of the whether they were going to enact all of the review changes suggested by the working group, and that went 10-0. Yep. So there is now a group being formed to basically go through and sort all this out, especially around the A-League, because they're looking to get it done by March next year.
Yep.
Yeah. Now so that actually was a separate vote as well, was to form an A-League working group. That also passed 10-0.
Nice.
There's a few different parts of this whole thing. So under the current setup, it has to be a 75% vote. Then the FFA's line of lobbying has always been that they believe the board should have independence from the game. So essentially their argument is stakeholder representation from pretty much anyone should be minimal. Most of the board should be made up of independently appointed people.
Like Stephen Lowy.
Correct.
From the business world.
So they have argued that that is the best practice governance, is complete independence. What the other parties, so the federations, the A-League, the women's game, have all argued is that actually in the situation that, you know, the sport is at, it actually needs a much greater level of stakeholder involvement at that level. And so the Congress needs to be made up of representatives of not only the federations, but the professional game, the women's game, and all that kind of stuff. And so I think you said that the FFA kind of didn't want change to happen. They were arguing that they did, but their makeup and their model they were suggesting involved much less representation for particularly the professional game. So they were still expanding the overall numbers, but they wanted the professional game to have a much smaller vote. And their big problem has been that, so the new system, unlike 75%, requires 60%.
And they changed the representative ratio as well.
No one group will kind of be able to have that anymore. So you need over 60%, so you need 61. Basically, the professional game will make up In fact, no, I think I have my numbers wrong there. You require 60%, and the state federations will make up around 59%, and the professional plus the women's game and the PFA make up around 41%. So both sides have to get some cross support. So grassroots game or state leagues or all that kind of stuff need help from the professional game to get a vote through, and the professional game need to get something from the state kind of block, if you want to think of these as blocks, which I honestly don't know that they really work as blocks. They do on some issues, but on others I think it won't. And so both sides have to work together to decide on the future of the game. And the FFA spent a lot of time trying to paint that as a big problem, that it would mean, you know, backdoor deals and all this kind of stuff. And I think it could well mean that, but it actually also forces each party to work with the other side to go, let's not only make decisions for the good of the professional game or the state game, but actually we need to consider both sides and actually work together to bring all of it forward. And, you know, his talk of independence when it was just basically a boys' club of his mates all pocketing nice, healthy fees and just, you know, doing it entirely for commercial reasons was not going to work either, because it didn't consider those other parts of the game that really needed to have a say over their own destiny.
I can understand why the A-League wanted, or why the FFA wanted to hold on to the A-League, because effectively it is the cash cow. It is the thing that drives all the income that they say they put back into the rest of football.
Let's at least give the Matildas and the Socceroos a little bit of, but they have very few games.
Exactly. The point, I think the stats were the A-League drives about 80% of the revenue that comes from that Fox deal.
That comes from the A-League.
Yes.
FA? APFA?
Yeah. Whatever they're Australian called. Professional Football Clubs Association, or something.
Whatever they call themselves, the professional clubs.
AFCA.
Yeah. They put out that number. The FFA and Fox have never put out a number themselves. But the reality is, this means that when an independent A-League comes about, which it sounds like it will, the new Congress sound like they will be all on board with that. They've already voted to create a working group on how that could work. But that doesn't automatically mean an independent A-League. The working group could recommend it's not independent, but I think it seems
unlikely.
A level of independence is pretty much a foregone conclusion. It'll just be what form that takes. But they will have the rights to sell their own TV deal and you know, be the masters of their destiny on that front, because at the moment they feel FFA have done a poor job negotiating that deal, and you know, they're not exploring good enough options and all that stuff. But it'll mean the FFA itself still has the Socceroos rights and the Matildas and the Joeys and all of that to sell themselves, and that revenue will still go to the FFA.
Yeah.
And you'd have to say, as part of however the independent A-League works, some of that A-League deal money will still be going back in,
but it will
be negotiated by the guys who have the biggest interest in getting the best deal.
Yeah,
I think it definitely has to. You can't basically cut out all of that money and just it'll be great for the A-League clubs, but, you know, football in Australia would perish pretty quickly, yep. I think, without at least a significant injection.
And I think one of the big things the clubs will say will be a good outcome from independence will be them all having to agree on how to do extra things. So marquee funds and, you know, all those kind of rule changes and stuff that the FFA have pushed through for a variety of reasons that have benefited a single club or two clubs or, you know, whatever.
Or a single person.
Well, suddenly.
Tim Cahill.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, we've got a fund that's available to everyone. Oh, we spent it all on Tim Cahill. You know, what is this nonsense? You know,
and then got rid of
that
it.
That sort of decision will be made by all 10 clubs and probably the PFA in agreement on how they're going to do that. And so there'll be a level of fairness or at least transparency about how it's operating. So you won't have millions of dollars on ad campaigns or marquee funds or all that kind of stuff that only kind of the FFA have either decided by themselves or have decided in discussion with one or two clubs. It'll be everyone agreeing on an approach.
So with this kind of agreement approach, it sounds like it's going to be quite good for the Knicks. And we've kind of touched on this before. What do we see as kind of the plus sides for the Knicks here? Obviously, stability of contract. The idea is that
stability of license. The biggest one is you take away the caveats of performance that we have to meet that no other club does.
That last part is the key.
Yes.
The licenses will all be on equal terms.
Yes.
So Domi was saying today, and I don't know how true this is, but he was saying on the radio that all of the licenses will need to be reissued, because I think technically it'll be a different entity running it. So the licenses will need to be a new license for everyone. So their 25-year licenses or whatever they are will still need to be redone. And all of them will be redone the same. Yeah. So whatever the terms are, whatever the conditions are, and there may well be performance-based elements in there, but everyone will have to meet them.
And everybody gets to negotiate what those are.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's not one person or one small group of people saying you have to do this. It's everybody that's got a vested interest in the league going, this is what we need each of the clubs to achieve. If that's what they do. Yeah. I mean, there's
I think it would seem very likely to me there will be some sort of caveats on license. I don't think this is going to be a free for all, but I think it's unlikely to be performance based. Yeah. I think around financial stability, given the league will suddenly become financially liable for if, say, a licensee were to fail. Mm. At the moment, the FFA are the ones who step in and bail things out.
Yep.
If the league has independence, they will be in charge of that. And so I think there would be some caveats around that, because I don't think the league will want to open itself up to just open liability on someone's club going bankrupt. You know, there'll be, well, if you failed this test, we're taking it back and we're giving it to someone else. You know?
So in that case, I've kind of got two questions here. One, if it's a new entity, do commercial agreements then effectively get renegotiated?
So this would be the interesting part, because I wasn't aware of that until Domi said it today, that there would be new licenses. But it makes sense it must be a different entity. So you'd have to hazard that those commercial agreements might not remain in place.
So
but
the
we
Fox
also
deal.
Don't know how long the working group might recommend as a transition, because there may be some transition period to this, in which case maybe they just let all the current agreements sunset.
What Domi said was that he was expecting there to be a decision made by May, and it would be the next season starting in October would be under the new group.
Correct. But whether the TV rights transfer immediately might not be true. That might be we'll wait for the current contract to sunset.
That's
at the
happen.
End of that, the TV rights will transfer to the new entity. So I think there'll be some of that sort of technical stuff behind the scenes that
I think
we may see current deals run out under.
Yeah. I think it's going to – the current TV deal will go, and then everything will be negotiated from the new company from that point forward.
So, I would expect so.
The TV deal won't be impacted by this change.
Yeah, I agree. I think you wouldn't want to get into a fight with Fox's lawyers over this.
No, because then they just won't buy the rights again.
Yeah, but you'll have a huge number of sponsorship arrangements behind the scenes, and there's all sorts of stuff there. There'll be contracts with the security companies, for example, and stadiums. There's all sorts of stuff that will need to happen here, and how long those run for, who knows.
So coming back to something you brought up, and I hadn't actually thought of this, was in effect the owners of these new licenses, presumably there's going to be a degree of due diligence done here, and also expectations of financial viability and that sort of thing. We already have at least one owner of the Brisbane Roar, the Bakeries Group, who have shown in the past significant issues with financial viability.
On more than one occasion.
We've seen that with Newcastle, but they seem to have turned a corner there and are certainly spending money hand over fist at the moment. And fair dues to them, they're seeing results. But we know that in Brisbane there has been these problems, and that they have a lot of instability, and that not a tremendous amount of money being spent to keep the club going. I mean, we've all heard stories of the Aloisi's meeting in a cafe because they don't actually have an office, and you know, not paying Ballymore, so they don't end up having training facilities and this sort of stuff. Do we think that either they'll, you know, there may be these requirements like straight up the bat, that you know they might say to the Bakeries Group, look, you need to show, well, you know, and I say Bakeries Group, everyone, to show their financial viability, you know. Trust, you know, setting money into a trust, doing that, whatever, or maybe even payments being held back.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, some of the stuff already works really well on a central level that has fixed some of those problems. For example, player wages no longer, because they're paid out of the TV deal, it's actually managed centrally. So there should never be a situation anymore where a player isn't getting paid because that money shouldn't be coming from the owner.
Unless it's a marquee.
Correct. But so there's a range of things like that are already in place, and I think they would be very loath to change some of that stuff. I think the club owners recognise some of those measures are in place for that reason. But I also think any sort of due diligence or that kind of stuff is likely to have some times put in. I don't think anyone wants to see a club immediately dropped. I think the way Domi's talking, you know, we're feeling safe because we now know that's not going to happen. There needs to be the 10 teams who are there need to be there next season and the season after. You know, we need some time to sort this out. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see that sort of stuff come in, but I don't think it'll be straight away. And I don't think you're going to see too much pressure put on the back crease, for example, immediately. But I do think they'll go, here are what we're going to put as the conditions of the new licenses. Everyone by this date, 2 years from now, needs to be meeting these requirements, whatever they are.
So do we think that there's any negative elements to this new world order? Kevin Ayers called it A-League 2.0.
I mean, there's potentially all sorts of issues. To list a few, it could set back promotion relegation by a long way, I think.
And expansion.
I think expansion will still happen, but it will happen in the most commercially sound way, because that'll make sense to the A-League.
It's going to take longer to get to that point, because it's going to take them longer to sort out what A-League 2.0 looks like.
To me, I think expansion gets put on hold fairly long term, because I know that the clubs, there's a lot of clubs out there that in the larger expansion propositions cannibalise a lot of fan bases. Sydney FC came out very strongly against it. Sutherland, I think it was.
SWS would be all right, and Wollongong would be all right. Yeah. There are several expansion bids that don't cannibalise that much of the support.
And that's exactly the thing. I think it just changes the criteria. I don't know that it puts it on hold much longer. I mean, we're not going to see an announcement in October, I don't think, which is what the FFA were talking about.
No.
It certainly changes that timeline. But they're talking of, two clubs and then another two a year after that. I think it's plausible that within the next two or three years we could be looking at having two or four teams.
I can't see four. I can see two because I don't think that the Southwest Sydney one goes through.
Southern Expansion. The Southern one, that's the one that cannibalises a massive section of their support.
But does the Southwest one cut into Western?
It cuts into Sydney, it by about by 10%. There's a very small amount.
It's essentially a large uncapped part of Sydney.
And Wollongong.
Fringes that do cut over.
Yeah, and Wollongong, far enough outside that it doesn't cut into too much of
it. It's a long way outside.
It is a long
way
outside.
They don't have the money.
This is the thing. They've got a good infrastructure.
The criteria change entirely. At the moment, the criteria is largely around money, because of the way they've set up that you basically have to self-fund for, is it 2 or 3 years?
Wasn't it?
You get no TV money at all for a set period. I think it's 2 years, and then maybe you start getting some. But you're needing $30 million just to start. The bids that exist that
but that's
have
running costs. It's not even set up costs.
Yeah. The bits that exist that have the money to physically, you know, stump up that sort of money are, you know, your Melbournes, your Sydneys, and they're the big cannibalization bits.
Yeah.
The ones that are actually good expansion and growth don't have that money. So I think how they assess it, but also how they fund it, will need to be decided by that new A-League group, because they will need to fund. You know, if you're doing a Wollongong, you need to be giving them money, because they might have infrastructure and desire, but they don't have running costs.
Just as an idea, when the next TV deal comes up, negotiate for a 12-team league and have the expansion at that point.
That makes logical sense as far as the funds go.
Yeah, because that way you'll likely get more money. You're offering more games, offering a longer if you do a 12-team, you may end up just doing a shorter season.
To negotiate that, though, you need to know who these teams are, which is why I think you'll see that process begin before that happens.
Yeah, but for that point in time.
It makes a lot more sense, unlike how the FFA have been running this, to actually signpost this a lot further, to say to a team 2 years out, you're getting a license, and actually have time to get that structure in place, rather than announcing, you know, 2 months out, start a team, we'll give you some concessions to the rules like they did with West Sydney.
Yeah, but what Wanderers Perfect Storm doesn't happen everywhere, and it's not likely to happen in other places.
Because they just changed all the rules for them. Mm. You know, going, you're allowed a shitload more imports, we're also going to pay for all your players, and we're just going to bankroll the whole thing.
And you go straight into a heavy soccer neighbourhood.
Yeah, you know, that's not going to happen.
There's nowhere else in Australia that could happen right now.
No way.
Yeah, so talking about other potential downsides to this, I think you see problems with promotion relegation, because it'll trying to set up a second tier under an independent A-League is a very different prospect to what you might have done with the FFA running the whole shebang.
Would it be fair to say that there is far less incentive for an independent A-League to set up a promotion relegation?
Not necessarily, but for it to be club-based, yes. If they were to do a franchised-based second tier, where it's much less expensive to be involved and, you know, but you have the prospect of promotion to a first division.
So similar to a handy premium kind of...
Yeah, there's certainly commercial reasons for that to exist, but how it would work and, you know, it certainly isn't the promotion relegation kind of in its purest form like you see in England or something where basically, you know, it's possible for any club to basically end up at the top. It's very unlikely, but the structure is such that it can happen. Sort of structure under an independent A-League anytime soon, if ever. And then there was something else I was going to say as a potential downside. Oh, I think the potential for it to become a very commercialized league comes into play. You know, it's franchise based. That has its own issues. But I think the concerns of all the money ending up with the FFA and them kind of running their own dynasty suddenly just shift to club owners potentially doing that. I think in the short term, they won't. I think most of those club owners are there for the right reasons. But 10 years down the track, when the clubs are all financially stable and doing all right, and, you know, everyone's got marquee players and all that kind of stuff's going well, I could see club owners just maximizing profit and taking it out for themselves. I mean, you know, it's very rare around the world to be running a profitable football club. But if they manage to get themselves into a position to do it, these are businessmen, you know? That's a potential problem that we could face in the future because of this. I don't think you see it soon, but, you know, maybe.
Well, speaking more short term, there's also been some news out of New Zealand. The finding, what was it, an inquest into... basically,
they call it an independent review.
Independent review into occurrences within New Zealand football.
I don't think this is short term, mate. I think this is quite some long term.
I was more meaning it happened today.
Yeah, fair enough.
There was a review into the kerfuffle that is the reign of
it's beautifully
Andy Martin.
Kerfuffle.
Well, the review wasn't that.
Tenure was looked at.
Correct. But I think the key thing to remember here is this actually all was sparked by complaints from 12 players from the football fans. That's where this all began.
True.
And I think they
should be commended.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. And I think the kind of first thing in the findings of the review is that it says that they found that the complaints from the 12 players were genuine and largely substantiated. So these complaints were true, is basically what that says right off the bat. In particular, they described Haraf's actions as, while they could be described as robust coaching, other behaviour crossed the line into bullying and harassment. So we had a national team coach that was bullying and harassing players, and that's the first kind of finding out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
12 players complained, and it was found they were bullied and harassed by their coach.
What I found interesting was that there were 13 complaints made by 12 football fans. So it sounds like one of the football fans complained beforehand and then they all complained afterwards as well.
Yeah.
Which, that's very concerning. I mean, it seems like there were issues that came out of the previous tours as well that were raised by one member of staff and one player, I think. The games against Scotland in Spain.
Yeah, well, they refer to two tours, the Spain tour and the Wellington tour, which I don't know about calling that a tour, but, you know, it is what it is. But no, so I think so much of that kind of played out semi-publicly. You know, we saw a bit of that with stuff, wrote an article around it from an unnamed player and then it got pulled. And, you know, there's all sorts of bits and pieces we kind of knew here. And because they aren't releasing the full documents, we may never know exactly what occurred here. What's her name? Philippa
Muir.
Yeah. In the press conference today, was talking about how she wanted to make really clear none of these allegations were of a sexual harassment type nature. This was bullying. This was verbal abuse. This was that level stuff. But we will never know what it was exactly. But I think it must be massively vindicating for those 12 players who took a real stand and basically put their careers at risk to have this essentially open, saying those claims were genuine and largely substantiated. That's
great,
a big deal.
Great risk often comes around with great deeds. So,
And so there's some pretty damning stuff around that. So it says that Haraf failed to respect the rights, dignity and worth of players. He was not fair and considerate, and his actions offended, humiliated or intimidated both players and staff. These actions were repeated. So this was a pattern of bullying behaviour to players and staff. And
it states specifically that it is in Spain and in Wellington.
Yeah, and so that's just a horrendous situation. And thank goodness the media coverage and all of that stuff brought this to light in a way that caused this review. And the other part you've referred to here that's equally important is failings were identified around how those complaints were dealt with, because it was very clear complaints had been made and were not dealt with. And then it all came to a head again in Wellington. And, you know, someone went, oh, actually, we need to look at this. And we probably need to look at how you manage those first complaints. And that's where the Martin and governance and all that kind of stuff comes in as well.
So just clarify for me the timeline. There was the I remember the manager, it's the manager of the Football Ferns, yep, had made a complaint in the tour. It came out later.
Claire Hamilton. Yes.
Claire Hamilton, yep. Thank you. Remind me again when she resigned. Was it? It was before the
prior
the
Wellington game. Yep. Yeah, prior to Wellington.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's made a complaint. That complaint hasn't been heard, and she's gone, well, this is, I can't deal with this, I'm out of here. And presumably, in an exit interview, this came up again.
Yep.
As reasoning why, and it didn't seem to make a dent. And then, fortunately, in a way, Wellington's happened, yep, where we could all see the results of what's going on, a very visibly deflated and really, I don't want to say disheveled, but, you know, they certainly didn't, a team that we know can be very competitive and is a very spirited team, just didn't seem to show it.
Yeah.
And that seemed quite obvious. So we've got obviously two issues. We've got the Haraf kind of first-hand bullying and seeming to be, to me, ill-equipped to, yeah, do the job that he was chosen to do. Someone, I think it was Pip Meor, made the point that he had come from a background of only men's underage coaching. He had coached through Austrian age group, yeah, but only ever boys. And she she brought up another point, I think from someone in Sport New Zealand, saying that basically it's not to say that sport for men and women is different, but you do have to basically be sensitive to the subtle differences within them,
yeah,
and that he was not able to deal with that. So we kind of, I guess, have to question how it came about that he was chosen. And take it away, Dave.
Well, I mean, I don't know that they're specifically are questions around how he was chosen as technical director. I don't.
True.
I think that, from my reading of this, and obviously this only came out today, and it's a fairly dense document, I think that all appears to be largely above board. Obviously, there were issues with his appointment as Football Ferns coach. That is a conflict under FIFA guidelines, and that kind of was skirted around. And, you know, this places blame fairly squarely on Andy Martin for that, for basically saying it was going to be fine and that was okay, and suggests a lot of due process was not followed for appointments, that one included. And it goes into a lot of detail around that. So the key outcome is basically that she identifies they did not follow their own processes. And at one point she describes it essentially as a sham. It says, however, staff and coaching appointments since then, this is since the appointment of Andy Martin in 2014, it says, however, since then, staff and coaching appointments have not always followed robust or New Zealand football's own recruitment and selection processes, and this has led to some candidates feeling the process was a sham. I share that view. Having seen Mr. Haraf's 100-day plan, an early draft of a PowerPoint plan, had a slide for New Zealand football national coaches that had all current vacancies with names beside them. Those names were taken out before it was presented to the Exco. However, all of those coaches listed were subsequently appointed by the technical director. So essentially what she's saying there is, you know, there's a whole bunch of guidelines and processes that should have been followed for coaching appointments, but very early on, Haraf presented a document that said, these are all the coaches I'm going to appoint. That document went through some edits and got shown to Exco around, you know, what sort of positions he thought were vacant and whatever. And then after they had approved that those roles should all be filled, he appointed exactly the people he had pre-identified, which, you know, it has to raise some concerns. Not necessarily that those people weren't the right people, but around the process of just being able to go, well, you know, we're going to have these jobs and we're just going to appoint the names that I've decided by myself.
So within
it's crazy.
within New Zealand football, as far as the structure goes, who would have the ability to appoint these other coaches? Presumably the technical director has input on this, but I know in normal circumstances it'd probably be the next higher, you know, the whoever the business person was that Haraf would report to.
Well, so reporting to Andy Martin. So
would it be Andy Martin that would normally be? Well,
it doesn't go into detail on what the processes should have been, but it details in some cases where things should have happened. So particularly around the appointment to the Football Ferns role, it says specifically they did not follow best practice. There was no recruitment or selection process, no PFA consultation, and FIFA guideline recommendations were not adhered to. So whatever the internal process that it says there, it wasn't followed. I assume that probably involves more than one person. I suspect there's a panel. Whether for every appointment that involves Martin, who knows? But I would suggest that for the women's national team coach, it does. But it sounds like none of those processes were followed at all.
So we're kind of alluding to a fair bit of responsibility to Andy Martin, but I know that Pip Muir went to fair lengths not to specify him. In fact, one of the first things she said, remind me if I'm going a little off key, was that due to his resignation/retirement and the confidentiality involved, is that she wouldn't be able to talk specifically about a lot of what he was involved with.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. She's covering, because what people would want is to hear his part of this. So she's basically telling us why that's not in there off the top, so she doesn't get unfairly maligned for him seeming to get off quite lightly for what.
Well,
his
let's call a spade a spade. He would have. The idea is that he would have got a fairly hefty payout as part of his settlement, as part of his exit.
I'm just going to read you the extract here so that people can read between the lines on what this means, or you're welcome to put the words in their mouth if you'd like in a second. But so it says, on June 29th, 2018, New Zealand Football announced that chief executive Andy Martin was retiring at the end of the month. The terms of Mr. Martin's departure from New Zealand Football are confidential. This limited what I can and have reported in this review about Mr. Martin. So I'm not going to say there was a hefty payout, but let's say there was a deal signed between the two parties for sure, because it basically says that, and let's assume that it has some confidentiality clauses in it. And so that's what she's referring to. There is some sort of binding agreement between New Zealand Football and Andy Martin around his departure that limited what she can say and have reported in the review. So whether that was confidentiality around some specific events or just in general or whatever, we'll never know. But when he left, he signed a confidentiality agreement. Yeah. And usually money would occur at that point too.
And to me, that seems quite unusual. If a person chooses to resign or retire, yep, they don't normally have confidentiality agreements, unless, of course, you're dealing with sensitive information, you know, a non-disclosure
that's
agreement.
More non-disclosure than confidentiality.
And that's not, this is by no means.
This indicates culpability. This indicates some culpability in the greater NZF organisation if they are prepared to have this signed and this payout done, which would stop him being. What's the word I'm looking for? Which basically rules him out of any kind of, or a very much wrongdoing within this report.
No, see, I think if anything, this should shine a light on how much blame is placed on him in this report, because it is a huge amount. About 80% of what's in here, reading between the lines and sometimes explicitly stated, he is to blame. Imagine what she would have been saying if her hands weren't tied by that confidentiality. I think he comes out looking terrible in this. I think so much of this is clearly shown to be his failings at managing the organisation and hiding things from the exco, that if this is excluding some stuff, my God, what a shambles.
Yeah.
Because he does not come out looking blameless at all. I think much of this...
Yeah, I'm not choosing my words right. I don't think he looks blameless, but I think it limits the amount of blame that can go on to him. I think and that's not saying it's a little amount. They're saying it's not as much as it should be.
Yeah. I think it probably means there's some specific occasions that are not talked about in here. That's what I think. I think some specific stuff is not in here rather than general things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
What I found interesting about what Philippa Muir has actually said in her report was a couple of pointed things. First of all was that the one about being limited, but also she mentioned specifically at the outset that she had spoken to Andreas Harrach right at the very beginning of the review, but that she'd contacted them after she'd made her initial findings to basically let him have the right of recourse, I suppose, to which he had not responded or didn't wish to. And I thought that was quite interesting. The fact that she pointedly said, you know, I contacted him, he didn't want to be involved. Do we think that's the last we hear of him? Do we hope that's the last we hear of him? Yes.
I think it's the last we hear of him in New Zealand, yes.
Yeah, so I certainly think that he doesn't come out at all well. I mean, my read was that basically his man management skills weren't up to the job, and certainly his woman management skills were even less so, and that the approach he took, he cut corners and basically didn't follow the sort of process he should have been and was also trying to wear two hats that he shouldn't have been wearing in the first place. I mean, that seems fairly obvious.
And I think it also identifies – so there's a lot of blame there, but I think also one of the big things – if you break it down into four kind of points – one of the main ones is player welfare, not only at an individual team level, but as an organisation. The structures in place around a complaints process, for example, were horrendous. The diversity kind of structures and, you know, player welfare in general, policies in many of those cases don't exist. There's no complaints process. No one knows what to do. And so when you are having a problem, the organisation as a whole couldn't deal with it. There's no HR processes, so there was no one in New Zealand but there's no dedicated HR function, so there isn't a person in the office to go, hey, we're recruiting, here's how we're going to do it and actually oversee that process. And, you know, just all sorts of failings across the organisation around things that should be in place to look after the players. I mean, they're a workplace. These are essentially employees, and they just were winging it. And so while there were specific failings on Harrach and Martin for sure, the organisation as a whole wasn't equipped to deal with them. And you have to wonder if the complaints process existed and someone had raised a problem after Spain and there were those structures in place, whether it would have ended up in the same place, whether someone would have, you know, taken that complaint to Harrach, it would have been dealt with well, and actually he'd still be here managing a team and understanding what the concerns were and everything would have been fixed.
Well,
a complaints process without an HR representative is a joke.
Well, there was no dedicated HR.
Exactly the point. So your complaints process basically rules out the people that know legislatively what you're supposed to do in this situation. End of story. You can't have a complaints process without that knowledge in the room.
And so it sounds like a lot of what happened. I mean, I don't quote me on this, but from my memory of reading this through this afternoon, I haven't highlighted this one, so I can't find it and check what I'm going to say. But basically, complaints were ending up with Andy Martin, and he was passing them back down to Harrach. What a shambles.
Yeah.
Like, if you're one of those players complaining about Harrach and thinking, oh, this is going to get dealt with at a senior management level, and it's just getting passed back across his desk. I mean, my goodness. And I can't remember whether that was a player or if that was
the tour report.
But there certainly were situations where these issues were being raised and passed back down to him.
My understanding was that the manager's end of tour report ended up going to the technical director, being the guy that she had the problem with in the first place. So
And so it's just
it's
crazy.
Fucking comical.
Yeah.
It's comical.
And so, yeah, there's a range of the kind of fourth area of discussion is around the exco's culpability and all of this and their awareness. And it sounds like in many cases they were oblivious because Martin was not correctly informing them, which is a failing of Martin. But also she highlights issues with their lack of oversight. I mean, their job is to ask questions of the CEO. They are overseeing the organization. So they weren't asking questions. They weren't overseeing. They were kind of asleep at the wheel in many ways. And in cases where concerns were raised directly to them, which I think I saw Andrew Gordy having counted them up, there are 9 of, but blame him for counting that, not me, because I haven't counted them. But there's a number of times where issues were raised directly to the exco, and they passed them back down to Martin and didn't follow up on them. And so she describes their dealing of with those issues as inadequate. And I think some of those issues rightly should have been passed down. So some of them around appointment processes and, you know, candidates who felt they hadn't been dealt with properly through the process. But even if the right thing to do was pass them down, I think there should be a level of checking up on that that should have taken place.
Well, I actually think the first thing you should be doing if those complaints are starting at EXCO is asking why they're there in the first place.
Yeah.
Because if they have a complaints process, that's definitely not go to EXCO first, right? There's no, got to be process.
But there wasn't a process, and that's the thing. And I think one thing that in a traditional setting, I would agree with that. You wouldn't go straight to the board with an issue like that. But these are volunteers on that EXCO. They're not paid. It's a volunteer position. And they're figures in New Zealand football. I think in a lot of cases, these will have been, so some of the complaints are former professional players, some of them are nominees for coaches. I'm not at all surprised that they feel they can talk to members of the EXCO, you know, flick them a text or flick them an email and just go, hey, by the way.
Probably standing on the sidelines at a game in some of those situations. I totally agree.
I think they're more approachable than your average board level governance would be for those to potentially filter there. I agree with you, it's not best practice for that to happen, but if it does come there, if that's how that pans out, I think they were right to go, oh, this one, we pass that down to the correct people. But
to me, it sounds like they weren't ever communicating that to the person who was making the complaint.
Correct.
And it seems like that should be the first thing you say. It's like, oh, have you taken this to Andy Martin?
Yeah.
In which case they go, yeah, that's why I'm here. And that, you know, there should be alarm bells ringing. It shouldn't just be like, oh, hand it off to, you know.
Yeah, there has to be some more, I don't know, open thinking outside the box. Think about why this is happening, not that's not my job, I'm just a volunteer.
So speaking of EXCO, you know, just coming back to it, it's they don't come out smelling of roses at this by any stretch, do they?
No, well, it says specifically, there's a whole section entitled Inadequate Responses by EXCO, and it says some EXCO members were or should have been aware of the above allegations and their responses were inadequate. That's reasonably clear cut. They failed at what they should have been doing. There are a range of reasons for that. You know, for example, Martin obscuring certain things from them and stuff. It sounds like there are a number of factors in play, but that's pretty damning. To say they were inadequate is pretty clear cut.
Okay, so let's shift tack slightly from the overwhelming number of indictments that have been levelled at parties. Let's go on to the recommendations. The public recommendations are obviously the only ones we know about.
Yeah.
But they seemed quite interesting, and I thought that Philippa Muir actually did a really good job. I've read them, kind of skimmed through twice, and it seemed like she had gone above and beyond the, you know, what you would think is the minimum level by any stretch.
Yep.
Like her mentioning of increasing diversity, pointing out the overwhelming lack of representation of women within, not just on the board, which is 0%, but
just in terms of staff.
Staff is like something like 21%, which is horribly low. Yeah. I mean, in my company, which is an IT company and traditionally awful at recruiting women, we're higher than that by a significant margin.
I think there's some really good stuff in the public recommendations. I think particularly meetings that have already been set up, to be honest, between NZF and the PFA, for example, since the new interim CEO has come on board. Because there's a recommendation in the Football Ferns complaints part of the recommendations that the NZF meet with the players that complained, preferably the wider Ferns squad and the PFA as soon as the team can be assembled. So the fact that they've already started meeting the PFA on a fortnightly basis is a step in the right direction. It's quite good. Recommendations around coaching pathways for women, which I had such a shock that wasn't in place already, because as far as I understand, New Zealand Left Football is supposed to be the custodians of that. They're supposed to be promoting those possible pathways that seemed to happen with the men's game when they had, you know, the Jose, the Dez and the Fritz with the two coaches, you know, going into the assistant roles. That seems to be there, but the fact that nothing like that exists for women at all.
It's funny the names you put out there in that, though, because none of those are local coaches.
And no,
absolutely a failing across the board on that, but particularly on the women's side of actually getting
a pathway from
you know, being a young kid playing football to being able to be a coach in New Zealand doesn't exist on either side. But on women's side, just being in the country, there's barely a pathway.
Yeah. No, I was ignoring where they were coming from, specifically saying that appears to be one when there is nothing on the women's side at all. And that's considering how well performed the Football Ferns are, that's a massive failing from New Zealand football.
And with the numbers that we have in women's football, I mean, we are well overrepresented as far as women's football goes, you know, per capita. So, overrepresented is the wrong word.
We could be better represented, but we're doing better than lots of countries on that.
Yeah, well, but I think they're calling out. I think someone actually said on Twitter today that there's looking at this review, there's a lot of sports within New Zealand that could be looking at these points and going, you know what, we should be doing more for the women in our sport as well.
Even states that herself.
Oh, does she? Okay.
She points out that
maybe that's what I've seen.
There are a number of failings in here that are true of many sports bodies in New Zealand, that this is not just football issues. Some of this is just football issues. A lot of this isn't. And
societal more than anything else.
Well, and just the nature of until there's a problem, many of these things just work. You know, you don't necessarily, you know, until there's a problem, you don't need a complaints process. But it needs to be set up for when there is a problem. And so I think lots of other sporting bodies, for example, will be, you know, getting by without some of the stuff in place just because they haven't had an issue like this occur yet.
Well, anyway, and they run on a shoestring. They don't have much money. Absolutely. The volunteers, all that kind of
stuff. And so some of the recommendations, you know, particularly around, say, that HR function that we've talked about is around finding a shared service for that. You know, talking to Sport New Zealand around going, hey, can we get a shared service HR person? So, you know, it's not just New Zealand football's HR person, but we've got a person dedicated that five or six organisations are all drawing on this one HR team or person, however that structure works.
To me, that seems so obvious that New Zealand
should. Let's all collectively develop how complaints processes should work. You know, let's design best practice as a group of bodies rather than leaving everyone to fly solo. So a lot of that stuff is in here around recommending that, but going specifically, you need to do this, but maybe you could do it this way, you know, and I assume, given these are the public recommendations, that there's even more detail on that sort of stuff in what they've been presented privately.
You see, this kind of really annoys me because it's like I look at groups like Sport New Zealand who, I mean, ostensibly all I can tell that they do is distribute funding for mainly around Olympic and high profile, you know, high performance sports. And I kind of sit there and go, it's just such a missed trick. You know, we've got so many sports within New Zealand
that need help.
That basically are run either on a volunteer or a shoestring basis who need support.
Yeah, it needs administrative support. I mean, the point that Dave makes about the external HR function is a recommendation in here to build an HR manager who builds a bullying, sexual harassment, inclusion, diversity, parental leave, and recruitment process. Those policies have to be there and they're not there. It's one of the recommendations. But if they can't get that in place themselves, having that external resource available resource, brilliant idea.
Well, I mean, especially when you kind of get to the point where you actually have paid professional players, the idea that you wouldn't have something in place just, it defies logic to me. It's like, you think about that in a work context. You imagine like a woman in your work going and saying, oh, you know, I'm pregnant. What do I do about parental leave? And then just going, oh, no, just, yeah. And throwing their hands in the air. It's just you'd be reamed. So the idea that we're paying players but don't have the infrastructure to do this, it horrifies me.
Actually, a parental leave process for a professional sports environment where you have professional female employees playing the sport, the fact that you don't have one is staggering. It is because it's so easy for a professional sports person to lose their livelihood. Yeah. And it's hard for them. I know from personal experience, from seeing family and friends, you know, get it back on the feet after having kids. It takes women a long time. There should be the processes, welfare processes, parental processes in there. And it honestly, it just really is staggering.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of stuff in this document. I don't know how much more you want to cover.
Well, to be fair,
we've been at this for a while. It's starting to get quite late.
Yeah, to be fair, I think we can probably wrap it up there. I think we've hit all the major points, but it's actually a pretty decent read if you don't mind reading 22-page documents.
Yeah, there's definitely some stuff in here we haven't haven't covered, like discussion around restructuring Exco and their responsibilities. You know, there's lots of recommendations in here that and findings. I mean, shit, the document is a gold mine of train wrecks if you want to go that deep down the rabbit hole.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that the bits that we kind of haven't covered, they'll come out eventually as these processes kind of go forward, hopefully, you know, the way ESCO is restructured, etc. So if you do want a copy of that, I'd suggest you jump onto Twitter and find either Jason Pine or was it Andrew
Gordy?
Just on
the New Zealand Football website if you'd like a copy of it.
Oh, okay. It's there as well.
Website. It's the it's not exactly obvious where it is, but the front page story currently is around New Zealand Football issuing an apology, which is one of the recommendations out of here. In that story, there is a link to this. So it's an apology and says to read the full findings, click here. So click there.
That is taking a bit of ownership, and I have to give them credit for that. Yeah. But that's a small amount of credit considering what they need to take ownership for.
Yeah. Agree. But I do think they could probably have these two things separate. I think the apology could just be the apology. Because that should stand on its own and is extremely important.
Before we finish up, I just need to stress again how much the New Zealand football community should be thanking those 12 women for taking a stand. Because without the stand that they took, this likely would not have happened, even with what we saw happening in Wellington. That was just on a footballing perspective, obviously. But without those 12 women, this doesn't happen. And we all need to stand up as a country of football fans and football stakeholders and thank them for bringing all of this to light.
Mm. Absolutely.
For sure. Basically, I think we'll wrap it up there. The only thing I wanted to add right at the end was the, ironically, the one thing that I believe Philip and Muir also mentioned was greater involvement in New Zealand football with the Wellington Phoenix as well, which I think isn't, yeah.
We could have a pot on that all by itself.
Yeah, I just wanted to slip that in the end. So I think we should probably end it there, lads, and go home to our lovely families. And more beds.
Yay.
Yeah, that too. So thanks for joining us from Cam, Dave and myself. Good night.
Bye.
Ka kite.
Train wrecks bring you.
Good fucking riddance brings you.
Yeah.
Martin out in 2016 brings you.
Clairvoyant yellow fever brings you.
We fucking told you so brings you.